Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, UFO Synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Greg Bishop. I also need to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone, simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. And my guest tonight is an author, researcher, and radio host, Greg Bishop. Greg has most recently co-authored the book, Weird California. Greg also co-founded the Excluded Middle magazine and eventually published the book Wake Up Down There, which is a collection of articles from the Excluded Middle magazine. Greg also published a book called Project Beta, which I highly recommend. It's a must-read. Project Beta was an attempt to set the record straight on the Paul Benowitz disinformation saga. Greg posts regularly to the UFO Mystic website, along with author and researcher Nick Redfern. Greg hosts his own fun and fascinating radio program called Radio Mysterioso, which airs live on Sunday evenings from 8 to 10 Pacific Time, and I recommend everyone to give it a listen. This is Greg's first guest appearance on Eye to the Sky, and I'm thrilled to have him on the program tonight. And welcome, Greg. You're a busy guy.
I like to make it appear that way.
Well, gosh, with all the work you do in the UFO-related topic, along with the other paranormal lump-it-all-in-one-sub interests, you keep your hands busy.
Well, after you've been in a while, you realize a lot of things are connected, and I think a lot of people realize that very early on, that, you know, there's lots of connections between ghosts and Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and UFOs and, you know, anything like that. And some of it even reaches into what people call the conspiracy kind of area.
I agree. I've got a semi-closet, I guess you could call it, interest in Bigfoot myself. I kind of follow along with some of that.
There's a lot of connections to that. Just type in Bigfoot UFO on the internet, and tons of stuff comes up, all the way from the ridiculous to the wonderful to the, you know, really intriguing. There was a really good case in 1966 that Stan Gordon investigated, the Kecksburg guy, where a witness saw two Bigfoot entities walking along a fence, and then they disappeared, and a UFO appeared. Big hovering, glowing thing, and then when the investigators came to talk to him, he suddenly, for some reason, had a psychotic episode and started yelling that the world was going to end. And it's a very weird and interesting case. I want to try and get Stan Gordon to write it up for UFO Mystic as a guest column.
Oh, that'd be interesting to hear. Most interesting casts, I guess you could call it, from, you know, Bigfoot research came from Bigfoot research organizations. Is it the Skookum cast?
Oh yeah, I've heard about that, but don't know a lot of details.
Oh, it's interesting. But to get back onto the UFO topic, and which is this what this show is all about. I could sit and talk Bigfoot as well, but.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well. I know we could, and I'm sure the listeners would enjoy that, too. But as advertised, it's UFO stuff or quasi-UFO stuff, so sure.
Awesome. I think my first introduction to Richard Doty was the UFO cover-up live program hosted by Mike Farrell. And that was, what, 89?
It was either 88 or 89. October. I think it was October of 88, actually, because I think it was the year before the Bill Moore MUFON speech.
That's right, it was. And Richard Doty and Robert Collins, a.k.a. Falcon and Condor, respectively, in silhouette.
For that program.
Pardon?
For that program.
Oh, they switch?
No, there's a big discussion going on now, which we could get into, about who Falcon is, and some people think it's Richard Doty, and I am 99% positive it was not Richard Doty. However, Robert Collins was referred to as Condor by Bill Moore and Jamie Chanderay because they were part of that circle called the Aviary. Doty used the name Falcon just to mess with people. He did this with Linda Howe, too, in the mid-'80s.
Oh, thank you for setting me straight on that.
That's my straight story of it. Other people have other opinions, but they think that Richard Doty is Falcon, and Falcon was not Richard Doty. Falcon was somebody who was a old-time OSS days type, that was his history, intelligence operative, and he was running the operation against Paul Benowitz, and we can get into that, too. But that was the person they referred to as Falcon, not Richard Doty. Richard Doty said that a few times just to mess with people because that's Richard Doty, which we can also talk about.
Okay. So was he Doty's boss during his time in the OSI at Kirkland?
No. What the AFOSI, which is the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, does is basically it's the police force or FBI for the Air Force. So if somebody's caught stealing money or, you know, bringing their girlfriends in after hours to places that they shouldn't see and things like that, just investigating law-breaking within the Air Force. But another thing they do is they're involved in counterintelligence, which means trying to thwart efforts by foreign powers or whoever to infiltrate our military secrets. But that's what OSI is concerned with, and that's who Doty was working for as an agent with OSI. But what they do also occasionally is cooperate with other intelligence agencies, Defense Intelligence Agency, the NSA, or the CIA, or whatever, on different projects. And one of these projects was a counterintelligence operation against the Russians, because this was late 70s, early 80s. And this guy Falcon had come out of retirement to run this operation, basically. And the UFO thing and Doty and MJ-12 and all that, as far as I can been able to determine, was just a little tiny part of this giant counterintelligence operation. And when UFO people look at it, researchers, they think that there was this big thing focused on UFO research and messing with them, and that I don't think that's close to the truth at all. But that's all they can see, so they think that that's what was going on. I think it flatters their egos to think the government was not helping them, obviously, but messing with them. And they weren't messing with them to keep the truth about UFOs secret. I think they were messing with them to pick up clues about who might be looking into defense issues, because they would do that with UFO researchers. In Area 51 in the early 90s, when people started going out there with cameras and everything, there were a few people who were not American citizens out there taking pictures and talking to people. And they didn't care about UFOs. All they cared about what was going on there and what was being developed under the guise of just hanging out and looking for UFOs. And that's the most obvious example.
Oh, well, yes, like Norio Hayakawa, when he was doing the documentary on Area 51 for Japanese TV.
Yeah, I mean, they were worried about him at the beginning, too, but I don't think there was any intelligence connection with Hayakawa. I think he really was working for Japanese television.
Oh, I agree. And now he has involvement with the non-existent underground base outside of Dulce.
Well, I happen to think after I wrote the book that there might actually be some kind of underground thing there, but I don't really think it has anything to do with aliens or UFOs or a battle with an alien civilization or anything like that, because two or three people who I trust and don't really tell me crazy stories have told me that, yes, they believe there is or was some kind of underground facility in there, including one guy who said that he had worked in underground facilities and the people that he worked with knew about that base. So, I don't know. You know, I can say, yes, maybe there was, when before I thought almost definitely there wasn't. But it would fit in with the whole intelligence operation just to mess with people and keep the question open and keep people guessing, and also the fringe benefit is find out who's asking about it.
Okay, for those of my listeners that aren't familiar with or haven't read Project Beta, which, by the way, I recommend that book to a lot of people who look into the Dulce thing. For those who aren't familiar with Moore and Doty's involvement with Paul Benowitz and what all happened with Paul Benowitz, can you give kind of like a rough rundown of what happened?
Yes. Let's see. Benowitz was a, he had a master's in electrical physics. He started a company called Thunder Scientific, which made temperature and humidity instruments for various defense contractors, scientific companies, things like that. He founded this company in the 1970s, I think the early to mid-1970s. And he lived in Albuquerque, and right on the border of Kirtland Air Force Base, K-I-R-T-L-A-N-D. A lot of people say Kirkland, like when you go to Costco, everything's from Kirkland. No, it was Kirtland.
I'm guilty of that myself.
Yeah. Did you say Kirkland?
Yes, I did.
Oh,
I apologize.
Okay. A lot of people put in Kirkland, and I think, no, it's Kirkland. I think it was named after a army general or something when the base was founded in the 1930s, I believe. Anyway, he lived right next to Kirtland Air Force Base, and he had an interest in the UFO subject. And at night in 1978, he discovered that he could see these strange glowing things sitting out probably a mile or two from his house on Kirtland Air Force Base, where he lives, looks right over the base. I mean, it's on a mountain, a hill overlooking the base. Saw these strange lights that would lift up off the ground and fly over behind this mountain and drop down behind it. It would do this, you know, many nights a week. So he started filming it and videotaping it. He also said he was picking up radio transmissions, which he said were anomalous, and he thought had something to do with the UFOs he was seeing. So he went in and told the Air Force about this because he was a loyal American citizen. He fought in World War II in the Coast Guard, I believe. And the Air Force, obviously, since it was happening on the base, they knew what it was. And to their mind, it wasn't UFOs, at least most of it. There are legitimate sightings of UFOs that were reported over the base. I mean, unidentified were the Air Force. Neither the Air Force nor anybody else knew what they were. Some of Benowitz's films may have been of these true unidentified. The Air Force knew what was going on. They told him, this is very interesting. Why don't you, tell us what you're finding out, and we'll keep in touch. And the reason they did this is because they wanted to know how he was finding out what he was finding out and how to prevent other people from doing it, and also to find out who Benowitz was talking to see if there was some kind of security issue, either witting or not, with him. And eventually, Paul Benowitz decided that there was an underground base under Dulce based on some regressive hypnosis he had done with a woman from New Mexico. And the Air Force decided to try and encourage him in this vein because it took his attention away from Kirtland and way out to Dulce, which is like 3 hours from Albuquerque. They also, the NSA, I believe, also set up a station in an unused house across the street from him and started beaming transmissions directly into his antennas that were on his house that he was picking up his transmissions with, basically broadcasting to him exactly what they wanted him to hear or see. And eventually, after a few years of this, 5 or 6 years of this, he had a nervous breakdown and his family committed him to a mental health facility. He was in for about 3 or 4 months. And when he came out, he basically stopped talking to other UFO researchers or making a big deal about it, although he still had an interest. And he died in 2003, about 3 weeks before I went out to do my first research for the book, which was unfortunate, but his family, I asked for their cooperation, and they told me to get lost, which is understandable from their point of view. Anyway, the AFOSI, the point man for that was Richard Doty, who monitored Paul Benowitz and from time to time fed him stories that either the Air Force approved or in all likelihood that Doty just made up himself based on his knowledge of the UFO subject. There's a lot more to the story, too. I mean, UFO researcher Bill Moore plays a huge part in the story, but we can get into that.
Oh, definitely. And considering what happened to Benowitz's mental health because of all of this shenanigans, I don't really blame his family for saying to anybody, you know, get lost, we've had enough of it.
No, I don't blame him at all. In fact, in the book, I specifically said in one part of the book, don't bother the family. They're not going to talk to you, and they don't want to, and they should be left alone.
Which I wholeheartedly agree with you on that point. They went through hell.
Yeah, and a lot of people say the Air Force and the various intelligence organizations drove Paul Benowitz insane. I think they basically stood by the side and fed him while his ideas got crazier and crazier, and they didn't try to dissuade him from his ideas. They would encourage his ideas, but from all I could find out, they didn't really tell him anything actually they did. Later, there were letters sent to him telling him that there was two races of aliens on the planet and that they had been here for thousands of years and they had put Jesus here to help with our development, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of the stuff you heard in the late 80s and all through the 90s and up to now. That was actually from a guy assigned to security with a defense contractor. So in that case, I actually did find some stories that were fed to him, but I think most of that came from basically nobody putting the brakes on. He didn't put them on. His family, I don't know if they did or not, and the Air Force and other intelligence agencies certainly didn't. So, you know, I don't say they bear no blame. They bear quite a bit of blame. However, basically he was unstable to begin with, as far as I can tell, from all the people I talked to. And that these are not just government people. These are other civilian UFO researchers and people that he knew in Albuquerque.
The story, the more I read on it, the angrier I got at what they did to this poor guy. I mean, they just strung this guy along for, gosh, how long was it? A year or more?
From about 1979 till about 1986
or 8. It's criminal what they did to the guy.
Well, I think it is too. And people, I've had a couple reviews on the book. People would say, "Well, I didn't evince any kind of moral judgment of what happened." And I said, "Well, that was not my job. My job was to tell the story, not to tell the reader how to feel." I kept my feelings out of it, or at least I tried to. No, I don't think what they did was right or justified. I think they thought what they were doing was justified, but that's the following orders argument.
True. But that still just torques my cookie really big time. Gosh. These guys didn't just stop with Benowitz. I mean, even today they're still spewing their garbage.
I don't think so, at least not in any official way. Because there's a lot easier ways to follow what people are doing now, mainly through the Internet and through ways to monitor, like the NSA does, monitor all phone conversations, all emails, all communication between people. You can find out what people are thinking and saying very easily. You don't have to, you don't have to go out and drive them crazy or string them along. All you have to do is listen to what they're saying to each other. And then, people like Bill Moore were recruited because they needed to know what people were saying and thinking if anybody was on to any kind of projects that the military or the intelligence agencies were working on or involved with. It's a lot easier to do that now. You don't really have to recruit people. The human intelligence part has shrunk a bit, at least in the UFO arena, I think. So, yeah, you can say that Robert Collins, we were talking about before, is still spreading stories and this and that. I don't think he's doing it officially. I think he's doing it because he wants to, and because that's an important part of his life that he wants to talk about with people. How much of it is true or not, I'm not even sure he's sure.
Recently Collins was on Coast to Coast here recently,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I listened to that show.
Pardon?
I listened to that show. I just happened to turn it on because a friend of mine said, hey, turn on. They got Bill Burns and Ron Collins and a couple other people on. I said, okay. So I did listen to it. And, yeah, I heard a lot of inaccuracies, and I heard a lot of things that I thought were fairly accurate, and a bunch of things that were, there's no way for anybody to check any of this out. In fact, most of the stuff he said, there's no real way to check any of this out. You just have to kind of know the history of the subject, what happened with those people, who was involved, and pay close attention to what he said, and then you can kind of figure it out. I don't have a point-by-point refutation or discussion of anything he said, but that's what I noticed when I listened to it. I like listening to that stuff. I like to hear how these stories are spun and what people are thinking and how all that plays out and how it affects people that are interested in UFOs. I'm not really here to whistle blow. It's just the interest of mine, the intelligence part of the equation.
Do you think an opinion that I have? But do you think that they continue to tout their work in all this, stuff like Serco and the Dulce stuff and whatever else that they've stuck their fingers into, the MJ-12 and whatnot. Do you think they continue to try and keep the story alive, to keep their names into the public eye?
I think that might be part of it. And these are all separate issues. I mean, the Dulce thing was something that happened, first came to attention in the early 80s when Paul Benowitz started talking about it. He was the originator of that story and that what do you want to call it, meme, that idea. The Serpo thing, as far as I could tell, and I'm sure you've read up on it, I think personally it was some kind of counterintelligence operation having to do with security on some military project. And it would take me a very long time and a lot of stuff I really don't want to talk about on the air to tell you how I figured that out. But when I saw the names that were associated with it, I thought, well, these people were around doing the Benowitz stuff back then, so why are people believing this story now? It's far more interesting to me to see what they were saying, how they were saying it, and who they were directing it at. And it had nothing to do with UFOs. I think there were a lot of words, phrases, sentences contained in the original things put out by Anonymous, as he or she or whoever was called sent to Victor Martinez through his list, because that's how it started. And the reason I'm sure of this is because they told Anonymous told Martinez to stop editing what he had written. He wanted all the bad spellings and bad grammar and whatever else was in there, and I think that's because there were messages contained in those things for certain people. And whoever was trying to track those messages and figure them out, they could figure out online who was downloading them, who was looking at them, and who the messages were, if they weren't getting to who they were intended for. Now, this sounds like something way the hell out to the left field having of anything to do with UFOs or government interaction with them, but that's the problem when people look at this disinformation stuff. They think it has to do with UFOs, and I think 9 times out of 10 it has nothing to do with UFOs. All it has to do with is basically bringing what Falcon used to call bringing moles out of their holes. People that are interested in things that they are interested in who they think do not have the best interests of the United States in mind. Does that make sense?
you know, I never thought of it that way with all the grammatical errors and the misspellings. I never thought that there could be a code behind all that.
Well, yeah, exactly. I didn't either, but I was told by a few people, well, why don't you look at it this way? And I could be totally wrong, and I could be completely steered the wrong direction. But what other reason is there for that garbage? I mean, there's no way to check that stuff out. It's rumors only. Nobody around says, I was one of the astronauts that went to the planet Serpo and blah, blah, blah. In fact, I think they said that everybody had died. So, you know, what are you going to check out? Nothing. The story makes no sense. It can't be followed anywhere. It doesn't relate to anything really in the UFO world. It's just a weird story. And the people who were involved in counterintelligence were originally were the ones that were touting it, you know, whatever it was, 3 or 4 years ago. Or I think it was more like 2 years ago. So what other conclusion could I draw? You know.
And again, for those who, you know, because I'm sure we've got quite a few listeners out there that aren't familiar with what the Serpo Project or
the
whatever
Serpo
you want to
Project
call it is.
Was a story.
Or it was supposed to be.
Yeah, a couple of years ago. It started on an email list that a guy named Victor Martinez has. What he started doing was sending out these messages from somebody who was apparently a government source, or said he was, a whistleblower, a deep throat, if you want, stories about an event that had happened, I believe, in the 1970s, where some alien civilization had left some, a la Close Encounters, had left some of their people here, and we had sent some astronauts to the planet, which was called Serpo, for a period of, I don't know, a couple of years, 7 years, I can't remember how long it was, and one of them had died there, and one of them stayed, and a few had come back, and, you know, wonderful, incredibly great, exciting story, which, you know, a lot of people would think, well, this would be great, I wonder if this really happened. But like I said, there's no way to, there's no real way to check it out, and the people that were trying to push the story were people that had been involved in disinformation before, at least one of them, namely Richard Doty, who appeared on on the Art Bell program, along with Whitley Strieber, Richard Hoagland, and I think Linda Howe, and discussed the merits of the story and said he had heard antecedents for the story way back in the 1970s so that he thought it was true.
We'll bring up Linda Moore again here in a little later because of some involvement with Collins and Doty and Linda Howe. And ask one of our listeners here in our virtual auditorium, Linda Keeper, she says in here, wasn't that a movie, Close Encounters? And I always thought, gosh, I wonder if that team of people there in the end of Close Encounters that were supposed to go on the ship and go with the aliens, if that was an inspiration for Doty to come up with the Serpo science fiction story and tout it as truth.
I don't know if he came up with it. I know I'm fairly certain he was involved with pushing the story to the UFO research community and interested parties. I think a lot of people give Richard Doty a lot more credit than he deserves for making up a lot of this stuff. I think he passed things along, talked to a lot of people, made a lot of misleading statements, and in some cases outright lies. But I don't think he authored a lot of this stuff, or any really indeed any of it. I think he's more of a salesman than a development person, if you know what I mean. That's my impression. After the Serpo thing came out and I wrote a column about it, Doty wrote me and said that the quote was, I was offended by your post. Take me off your list. I don't want to talk to you again. And I haven't spoken to him since then.
Well, and then that's like Victor Martinez. That guy is a piece of work on his own. He's sent out mass emails meaning mass emails out to mass numbers of people, and somehow he got my email address for the program, you know, for the show, and they were so full of such ridiculous stuff, and we had asked him, please, you know, take this email off of your list. We don't want any of your mailings. And I think like the second or third time we requested that, we got an email back from him calling us every foul name in the book and calling us skeptics and unbelievers and just a nasty email.
If it indeed came from him.
It was signed Victor Martinez, but...
Well, you know,
I don't know.
You don't know where they're coming from. It may have indeed been Martinez. I mean, I don't want to defend him, and I don't want to, you know, I was going to say I don't want to cut him down, but the thing is that the emails I got from him off that list and others that he sent out, I would look at them, and I think I would delete, like, you know, 9 out of 10 of them. 95 out of 100 of them I would just delete. And eventually he stopped sending them to me. I don't know why, and that's fine. But and also, I actually met him. He came over, and a film crew interviewed him in my house.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, in fact, I told him what I thought was going on with Serpo and how much I disagreed with him, and he didn't care. It was very he didn't have any problem with me for telling him I thought that the stuff he was spreading was made up and completely untrue. He said, fine, that may be your opinion, it's just convincing to me, and proceeded to tell me why he thought it was convincing, and I didn't agree with any of it. But we didn't get in a fight over it, so maybe he's different by email if that indeed was him. There's a lot of people like that. People get very very nasty over email, and then when you meet them, suddenly they try to be apologetic and all that. I don't know. I think it's a wuss-out way to go about things, but that's just me. If you're going to be nasty to somebody, if you're going to write to somebody on a list or in an email, I think you should treat them exactly as if you were standing right in front of them.
Well, and then to quote a snippet from Robert Hastings' Operation Bird Droppings,
mm-hmm.
If you accept all this information mixed in with maybe, you know, a little drop of truth wholeheartedly with no corroborative evidence or official documents to back up what's being said, then you're just helping to spread this information and doing the work for these people so that they don't have to. So every time you repeat this, there's somewhere in some dark office, there's a disinformation officer kicking back and just horse laughing their head off.
Yeah, you know what? Hastings says that, and he's got, you know what? I think he's got a different philosophy of how he goes about the UFO thing than I do. And I'm not saying he's a bad researcher or anything, but he's got a different idea about things. I think he wants to save everybody and make sure everything's clean, which is great. I think that's nearly impossible, so I don't bother. Because people are going to buy crap, they're going to buy crap no matter where it comes from. So let's plug up this MJ-12 leak, and then the world will be free of junk in the UFO field. No, it won't. There'll be tons more junk making it look silly and stupid. That's the nature of the subject matter because of the way our society looks at it. So I prefer myself and to tell people, use your own judgment, look at what, you know, examine information and evaluate it in your own intelligent way and decide if it's worth something or not. Telling people, you know, proving that something is disinformation or wrong, I think to me is a waste of time. Even though I kind of tried to do that in Project Beta. But the thing was, is it was a human story about an intelligence operation which happened to have a UFO connection to it. That's how I looked at it, and that's how I thought that more people would read the book, and so did my editor. And he was right. That isn't to say I don't believe that there are strange things flying in the sky that people have been seeing for hundreds and thousands of years, and that there is a non-human intelligence that interacts with us occasionally. I do think that. But what I don't think is that you can control the public perception of what the UFO community is like. I'm almost certain that's always going to be, for the most people, typified by a guy sitting in his mother's basement and running around on the internet and yelling at people. And that's not true. I don't think it's true. But there's nothing I can do about it. So, you know, it's a search more for personal answers and education, and it should be for most people than a crusade. Because the subject itself, it just doesn't do anything we expect it to. And it keeps confounding us and going to continue doing that. And I think that's fascinating, and I think it points us in directions that are that show us where our ignorance lies and what we yet have yet to learn. And unfortunately, that's also a magnet for people with crazy ideas.
Well, if like someone, you know, has been a skeptic all their life, and they have a sighting that just blows them away.
Mm-hmm.
So they go in and they start educating themselves on the
subject. Right.
If they don't have a brain with a good BS filter in it, and they start seeing all of this, well, I think you put it very succinctly, crap, you know, how can someone who's just getting into this filter out that from the good stuff? I mean, the stuff that's got the documentation to back it up, good sighting reports, like, say, for example, the Stephenville incident. You know, and all this. How can someone who's just getting into this separate the wheat from the chaff?
Well, like I said, with the UFO subject anyway, I think it's a personal quest. It depends on your own personality, your intelligence level, and what you want to find. That's another thing. I mean, if you're completely open and you're reasonably intelligent, you will gravitate to the stuff that's not as outlandish, has a little bit of information and study and documentation to back it up. And if you're not, you're going to gravitate towards the junk. A good way to start, I think, is to go to forums and look and see what people are saying, internet forums like yours, and blogs like the one Nick and I run. I'd like to think it's reasonable and doesn't spread any junk. At least I hope not, or the Paracast forum or something like that. See what people are saying. If you think they seem reasonable and they're not name-calling and all that, and saying, well, what do you think, and, you know, civilized discussion, you know, ask those people what they think. I see this on forums all the time. In fact, I just answered one where somebody said, what UFO book should I read? I'm just kind of getting into this. And I gave my suggestions, and other people gave theirs. And I didn't see a dog in the lot. They were all good suggestions, to me anyway.
Now, again, it does get difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff. Another subject that really kind of drives people crazy, myself included. I mean, I sat on the fence for so long over the validity of maybe some of the MJ-12 documents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'm still kind of on the fence about it. I'm about
Me
got
too.
Myself convinced. Pardon?
Me too, on some of them.
I'm starting to think that the MJ-12 stuff is a form of misdirection to get people to look, oh, we got to find this stuff. We got to find information on this person that's involved with MJ-12 or that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a misdirection tactic to get people to look away from the real group, if you want to call it that.
I don't think it's a misdirection. I think it's a bunch of stuff. You have to remember that I don't think there's been any quote unquote MJ-12 type document released to anyone in the last 15 years or more. The last batch of them came from this Tim Cooper fellow who had the documents that are the second wave, so-called, of MJ-12 documents are in the possession of Bob and Ryan Wood now, and they're the ones that are doing the research on them. The first batch, if you want to call it that, was the stuff received by Bill Moore in the 1980s.
Yes, Bill Moore and Jamie Chandray.
Yeah. I have a copy of a book that Bill Moore wrote in the in 1988, I believe, called the MJ-12 documents, where he goes through every single thing that he got through his connections and decides whether they're real or not. And a half or more of them, he said, probably not. Maybe another 20% of them, he said, these are undetermined. And then two or three of them, he said, these are fairly... There's no reason why we should believe that these are real. The funny thing is, the ones he said, well, there's no reason why we shouldn't believe these things are real, didn't really have anything to do with UFOs. They had more to do with defense projects that were very secret at the time. But I think, like I said, these were released to Moore to see if anybody would come sniffing around and asking him about them. And then they could check up on those people. I will revise what I said. I think that most, if not all, the MJ-12 documents were cooked up by somebody. Somebody with a good knowledge of history and a good knowledge of what UFO researchers were looking for and still are. And most, if not all of them, can't be fully checked or vetted or whatever you want to call it to the point where there is unequivocal evidence that they are real. I was trying to think of an example. That SOM 101 document, how to deal with alien civilization and crashes and all that. I don't think there's any person mentioned in there. There's not a year on it. And there's no real way to check it out. I did, but, you know, there are issues such as the one I wrote about on UFO Mystic. Bob Wood, who I mentioned earlier, and his son, who have some of these later documents, was at a conference in 2000, I believe. I was at this conference, Society for Scientific Exploration. He did a presentation on one of the documents they had gotten. And he took it, I went up and talked to him later, and he took it out of his briefcase and showed it to me. And it was this yellowing paper, and I can't remember exactly what was on, you know, written on the paper, but it had to do with dealing with some sort of extraterrestrial civilization and what they should do about it. No names, anything like that. Maybe a couple mentions of Department of Defense, the Army, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing was, I looked at the paper and handled it, and there were little holes in it, and I said, what are those holes? And he goes, well, that's where we did forensic document examination. I said, what did you find? He said, the paper is from the time it's aged with in the proper amount of time for that period when it was supposedly printed in the 1960s, I think. The ink was composed of pigments and dyes that were used at the time. And so I'm looking at this and thinking, well, if I think they're all fake, what is this doing here? And what am I to make of this? Except that either one, the government knows about UFOs and aliens and they're really concerned about them and they know a lot more than we do, which I seriously doubt. Or two, somebody was spreading disinformation in the 1960s. Which is not out of the realm of possibility, and not to UFO researchers, but to people like the Russians or the Chinese.
True.
So, you know, a lot of people say, well, why can't you just go with the Occam's razor and the obvious that the government knows about UFOs and everything? The reason I don't is because I think that whatever it is that's causing these reports and that people are seeing stepping out of ships and abducting them, if that really does go on in the way that we think, I think they don't know what to do with it and they don't know how to control it. They want to make everybody think they do, but I don't think they do. They don't have the control over the situation, if there is one, whatever situation there is, this mystery. And why admit that to anybody? So let's just keep people arguing about it and all that and throw them a bone once in a while so they'll keep arguing about it in the wrong way.
And you know,
not admit our ignorance and helplessness.
And I hear lately I've come to the opinion that I think the branch of the military that we keep harping on, a.k.a. the Air Force, is the wrong branch of the military to start digging into. Personally, I think the Navy has a lot more to do with it than the Air Force does.
Well, in the mid-90s, from 95 or 6 or so, for about 3 years, I had a guy from the Navy who said he was from the Navy passing me all kinds of documents and weird information. And I only publicized little bits of it, not in a big way, in my magazine. And this has been an idea that's been going out, going around for quite a long time. But then I suddenly noticed this, you know, in the last couple of months, all over forums. What about the Navy? What does the Navy know? And I don't think you're going to get much more out of the Navy. And I think maybe they possibly know, you know, have a little bit more interest in the subject because they never say anything about it, which would be a smart thing to do. But anyway, yeah, this guy had definite connections to naval intelligence. He was not in naval intelligence, as we found out later, but we found after he died in 1999, I believe, my friend, who will be on the show with me tomorrow, actually, on my show, went to his storage space and found letters written to him back and forth between a guy who was in the Navy or appeared to be. So I think he was somebody hired on to mess with UFO people and run their own intelligence operation. And they used to appear at UFO conferences once in a while, like a bunch of Navy guys in their pea coats and all that hanging out in the early 90s. I can't remember what the name of the group was or what they called themselves. But, yeah, there's a definite Navy influence or interest, and it's been really kept quiet for quite a long time. I think that there should be more people looking into that connection. I guess people think of the Air Force first because of their history with the subject, and plus they're the Air Force. You know, it's an unidentified flying object. But there's plenty of things going on in the oceans and over the oceans that the Air Force might not know about.
All of this is true. We have a question sent in by one of our, again, a member of our virtual auditorium, Tall Dwarf, would like to know, of how much that we know, how much could actually be disinformation supplied by an underground group or groups?
That's kind of a big question.
Comes up with some good ones.
Yeah. Well, it, like I said, it's a very vast question. I mean, it's not specific. Like I said before, you have to look at the information and see how well it holds up. And there's a huge, huge maybe or gray basket, no pun intended, going on in the UFO subject, at least with me. Yes, you know, definitely people have seen things that are unidentified. Yes, definitely people have seen beings or things that appear to be living and intelligent that aren't human. I'm fairly certain of that. Then you go into, was there an MJ-12 group that was concerned with UFO information and how that should be disseminated to the public? I tend to think not. I tend to think that there was the MJ-12 group, but not they didn't really care about UFOs, and since they were so secretive and such a small part of the history of the U.S. government, somebody who made up these original, like the Eisenhower briefing document that everybody knows about that lists all the members of MJ-12, I think somebody knew that, somebody in the government, and decided to hang all the UFO stuff on this MJ-12 designator. Because there's you can't find anything on it. The only time you find it mentioned is in stuff that has UFOs with it, except one thing, which is the Cutler Twining memo that was found in the mid to late, I think mid 80s, by Jamie Chandra and Bill Moore in a government archive, and they were led there too. I mean, they were given hints on where to find it. But the thing is that it doesn't mention UFOs. It doesn't mention any, you know, anything like that, or the Roswell crash, or aliens, or anything. All it says is that General Nathan Twining can't attend an MJ-12 meeting, which he'll have to be scheduled in later, or something like that. They'll have to move the meeting. It doesn't say anything about MJ-12, what MJ-12 does. It just tells you that there was an MJ-12, and I think they were led there just so people would think, well, yes, there was an MJ-12, so all the stuff about UFOs must be true too, which is wrong. That's the wrong way to think about it, at least to me.
You should
probably trust the civilian UFO research a lot more than you trust anything that comes out of the government, but I don't need to tell most people that.
Oh, I agree with you on that point, 100%. However, I do think that there is an M12-esque, you know, group in the shadow government, if you pardon the expression.
I'll pardon it. I think there is, too, but I don't think it's a group, and I don't think they have meetings. I think it's a bunch of people that are interested in the subject communicate with each other in an informal way, which may be used formally or officially in other ways. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I don't know why I said that. Go ahead.
I kind of point to an interview with Wilbert Smith, who was head of the Canadian UFO research back in the 50s and 60s.
You ought to talk to Paul Kimball about that. He's done research on Wilbert Smith and found out that basically he was a low-level government employee that had an interest in UFOs and that he wasn't nearly as important as most people think. He has a very detailed examination of Smith up on his website above top. Now he's going to get mad at me. I can't remember the name of his website, but it's Paul Kimball's website.
I'll have to check that out. I had read an interview segment of him with another individual from an old. The Other Side of Truth. Is that it?
The Other Side of Truth. Yes. Thank you very much. And
yes, David found that for us. Thank you.
Forgive me.
Oh, that's all right. David's good at finding stuff real quick for me. He's right on the ball.
Yeah. Look up Wilbert Smith on his site, and there's a good story about Wilbert Smith. And Paul is Canadian, so he had an interest in finding this out. And what he found out was that Smith is not nearly as a bigwig as most people would think him to be, as first revealed in, what was the book, UFO Crash at Aztec by William Steinman, where the I think Smith was first discussed, or it's first discussed in detail, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, what I was referring to was a segment of an interview with Wilbert Smith from Frank Edwards, I believe it's Flying Saucers Here and Now or something like that, where he was telling
I was mistaken. Yeah, go ahead.
Where he was saying how he had handled, quote unquote, a piece of hardware from a craft, and when asked, well, what did you do with it? Did you return it to the Air Force? And he said, no, I gave it to a higher power. He was asked, well, who? And he says, I can't tell you.
Well, see, this is a mistake a lot of people make. Who gave him that piece of metal? What did they tell him? Did he believe them? And why can't he tell you these things? And, you know, they're all these weird dead-end things. And they're very easy for people who have a belief system, believe in it strongly, to make one assumption about it. And then very easy for people like, you know, obviously on the other side, a fundamentalist skeptic, to make the other conclusion. And I try to stay out of that. And my question is, maybe. But, like I said, where did he get that piece of metal? How did he know it was from a UFO? Just because somebody told him? Did he see it pulled off of something that didn't look like anything that we had, you know? There's so many of these questions that remain unanswered. So you have to take a lot of, you know, if you take too many things on faith, you're messing up your data points to the point where it doesn't make any, you know, there's nothing there anymore to back up your belief system. Well, you know what? A belief system doesn't need any backing it up.
Oh gosh, and here I have this philosophy that UFO research is not a belief system.
I think about 90% of the time it is. But the thing is, a lot of human endeavors are a belief system. The point is how much evidence can you come up to convince somebody who's not part of your belief system that it's not just a belief system and that it's backed up with facts? And in the UFO arena, that's the answer is not very often.
True. And on that point, we have to take a break. Okay. We will be back here in about 8 to 9 minutes. And we'll be back here with Greg Bishop on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Now here's your host, Dee Andrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on Newperion 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight we've been talking with Greg Bishop. Greg, part of this aviary condor falcon mess, some of the stuff that they did was involving Linda Moulton Howe. Moore said that the reason why they were, you know, the aviary, I hate using that term, but that's what they call themselves.
No, that's what Bill Moore and Jamie Chandra called them.
Oh, okay.
It was an informal group. It wasn't this group convened by the government and all that. It was just a bunch of people that had a similar interest. A lot of them were intelligence people, people in the military that had an interest in the UFO subject, but also were doing their jobs protecting secrets. And they all communicated with Moore and Chandra, and just to not have to say their names on the phone or in public, they gave them bird names and called them the aviary. That's the origin of the aviary. And people seem to think it was some big official government secret thing that Moore got into, and no. It was just a bunch of people that were kind of a circle of people with similar interests, that's all. And some of them were involved in disinformation, some of them were not, some of them were involved in scientific research. It went all over the map. The thing they all shared was an interest in the UFO subject and finding out what it was and what the source of the reports and the phenomenon was. Is.
Very well put. They claimed that what they would do, they'd give this information to people to check and see how thorough a researcher they were to see whether they could catch the disinformation from the real thing.
No, and, well, they did that with they did that with Bill Moore, and apparently, so the legend goes, and it was told by a few people, including, of course, Moore himself and Doty, that Bill Moore passed because they didn't want somebody just spitting out, new information. They wanted to use him in another way and at another level or whatever. Linda Howe, they thought that she could be another one that they could use to either put out disinformation or and we say disinformation, people have different ideas of what that is. Disinformation is not lies, although it is infused and injected with them. Disinformation is a tiny bit of real information that you can check out that is easily confirmed, hooked onto a bunch of stuff that you can't confirm at all. And so, the true part drags along all the crap. And if you don't know what you're looking at, you don't know what the true part is, you can't really figure it out. But if your belief system is such that you're going to believe all the junk in there, then it works. But what Linda Howe was somebody that they were also looking at as somebody to either work with them or for them, I think. But most likely was just somebody they were wanted to use to spread some more stories. And I believe it worked for a while, and then later she wised up a bit and stopped listening to them. But in the 1980s, I can't remember what the date was, but it's in Project Beta, she was brought to Kirtland Air Force Base and taken into an office with Richard Doty, and he handed her a bunch of documents and said that she could read them, but she could not ask any questions or take pictures of them or anything like that. She was only allowed to look at them. And a lot of them were, I think, were probably a lot of these MJ-12 things and then some other things that were probably we've never seen. But basically it was saying the government was interested in UFOs, knew what they were, and there were deals with aliens and all this, all those stories.
Didn't some of those documents a different form, so to speak, they weren't the exact same documents, but they were had this same name that of the documents that were shown to Howe. Didn't those turn up on the desk, so to speak, of Timothy Good?
I don't know, because all we're relying on is her memory of what she saw. If she's the one that said that the stuff came to Timothy Good, then yeah, maybe it did. The thing was, a lot of people don't realize it is that the Eisenhower briefing document, the first one, the first shot out of the cannon in the MJ-12 war or celebration or show or whatever you want to call it, was sent almost simultaneously to Tim Good and Jamie Chandra and Bill Moore, And the reason that it was announced by Moore and Chandray at the 86, I believe, National UFO Conference, was that somebody in the government said, you release this stuff because Tim Good has got it too, and he's about to publish a book with the document in it, so he's going to scoop you. So, yeah, some of the same stuff was being sent to Tim Good.
Okay.
I don't know if it's the same stuff that Linda Howe saw, but if that's her memory and the way she recalls it, then I have to go along with that.
Oh, I just got another good question here. This is from Gossamer777, and he would like to know, what do you think of what J. Edgar Hoover letter, where someone asks him if the FBI is going to investigate UFOs, and his answer was, we would have to have access to anything recovered. And he mentioned the Army snatching up a recovered object in the early 40s, I believe, and not letting anyone else have access to it.
What do I think of that?
Mm-hmm.
Did Hoover know exactly what was going on? That's my comment.
Because he's
Hoover and head of the FBI doesn't mean he knows everything.
This is true. From the memo that this individual is talking about, if I remember correctly, part of it was saying, okay, I was told it was a letter that was released through FOIA.
Yeah, I've seen the letter, and it's basically he said, we'd like to get something on it, but there's nothing, because the Army has that all, and they won't give us any of it. That's the gist of the letter, as I remember it, and I think that's the one you're referring to.
Yeah, that they wouldn't let the FBI have even so much as a cursory inspection.
And besides,
from the point of view
of the military, what business does the FBI have in any of their business? They're not. The FBI's job is to investigate crimes within the United States, not crashed UFOs. So, maybe Hoover heard these rumors and said, could we get something on it? And somebody in the Army says, well, no, we're keeping it. And who knows what they were keeping? Maybe they're making him think it's UFOs when it's one of their projects. I don't know. I have not made my mind up about Roswell. I'm fairly certain that nobody is ever going to figure it out, because it's like the JFK assassination. There's almost equal amounts of information for and against the conspiracy angle. I tend to believe with the conspiracy angle because that's my personality and my bias. But
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, the information looks good to me, a lot of it, and a lot of it is not refuted very well. But it's the same thing with Roswell. I mean, there's so many problems with a lot of the witnesses and stories that have changed, and the newest thing is this non-bendable metal thing that has just come up recently that Frank Warren announced. But at the core of it is somebody saying that he was shown something, but he was told it was from a UFO, and then he had to give it to somebody else or give it back. There's no documentation. There's nothing apart from somebody saying something. And plus that kind of metal, which is called nitinol, which is a alloy of nickel and titanium. I looked it up just today. I looked up the development of it, and unless you think it's a big cover-up, it was developed in the by 1960 by a naval weapons lab, I believe, which to me says that humans are perfectly capable of coming up with strange alloys of metal. They don't need aliens to tell them that. But then there's questions like, what was that metal that unbended itself after people crumpled it up? What were those little symbols on those little struts, which I'm fairly certain that Jesse Marcel Jr. would not mistake pieces of Scotch tape with holiday symbols on them for alien writing. So, like I said, there's so many different things on either side of the debate that it basically is, if you believe that there's no UFOs, or at least that an alien craft didn't crash at Roswell in 1947. There's plenty of evidence to back that up. And if you believe there was an alien craft that crashed at Roswell in 1947, there's plenty of evidence to back that up, too, depending on your belief system and your bias.
Well, we know something came down.
Yes, definitely. Something came down that the Army was very interested in and very interested in not letting anybody find out about.
And personally, I don't think it was any Mogul balloons. I really don't.
I'm fairly certain it's not that or crash test dummies either. And then, of course, there's Nick's Body Snatchers in the Desert book, which a lot of UFO people got very angry with. And
I know Friedman did.
Yes. Well, I don't know if he was angry. I mean, I went to a conference with him and with Nick and Stan Friedman. We all had lunch together. They get along fine. They just don't agree, which is great. I mean, that's the way things should be. You can agree with somebody completely, but still go have a beer with them. I think that's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. It's like, my producer, Joe, we have an agreement that we agree to disagree.
Yes, exactly. Agree to disagree. Quite a civilized way to go about things.
Yeah, there's a lot of things I don't agree with him on, and there's a lot of things that he doesn't agree with me on, so we're just fine with that.
Was there a comment about how I answered that FBI question? Because, if I don't know completely about something, I'll give a comment on it, but that's only my opinion. I'm not telling people how to think or that they're wrong or anything like that. I was just engaging in some speculation because with that letter, from what I know, that's all you can do.
He says yes.
Okay,
he says excuse me. He says that's perfectly fine with him. I've got a question. See, last night after Angela Joyner's program, quite a few of us were stuck around here in the chat room and was talking, and Grant Cameron and Angela and myself and several other people, and we were discussing, you coming on tonight. And Angela Joyner asked
about me behind my back.
Pardon?
People are talking about me behind my back? Oh, no.
Oh, no, it's all good.
I'm just joking.
but she came up with a very interesting question, and Grant said, yeah, I want to know the answer to this one, too. Do you know who was Doty's boss? I mean, like an actual name of who was Doty's boss?
I think Ernest Edwards for a while. But a lot of people know that. He was the head of AFOSI at Kirtland for a while. Colonel
okay.
Ernest Edwards, I believe. If they're talking about Falcon, yeah, I know that name. But I'm not going to reveal it until I have it confirmed.
Ah. I will be sure and let them know because they were saying, I got to know.
Well, the thing is... Wait, can you hear me?
Yeah.
The thing is that the only way to confirm it is to ask other people who are in the aviary, and nobody trusts them. So if I reveal it and tell everybody, nobody's going to believe it or care, say, well, there'd be all kinds of problems with it. So, as I said on one of these forums here, I don't even know why I bother with it. I think I bother with it because I want to know for myself. And if it's okay with me, that's fine. And if other people disagree with me, too bad. They haven't been through what I've been through, and I almost don't care what their opinion is. But the thing is that I would like to find out for myself and have at least a couple of these people say, yeah, that was the guy. And the couple I've talked to recently, other aviary people, have been very coy with me because I just sent them a picture. And they're like, well, that's the way, a lot of people look like that. Like, okay. You want me to give you the name first, don't you? And I won't.
I understand your reasoning, and I agree with it. As you can't come up with some way of saying definitely yes, concrete proof, then I don't blame you.
Yeah, I can't come up with concrete proof, one, for myself, and if I can't come up for myself, how do you think it's going to look when I write an article about it?
Exactly.
Although, if I do... Somebody else may come up with a much better way of looking into it than I do. So that's the value in it. If people are interested enough, they'll do work for you and get back to you on it. I write a lot of stuff like that. I write a lot of stuff in UFO Mystic. that doesn't seem to really make any difference and doesn't really have any relevance to what's being said or is not that important. But I know that if somebody who knows what they're talking about sees that, they will get back to me.
That's true. You get that no matter what you're doing. David just reminded me that last night he was checking the stats on my website. And we got a hit from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, who does work for the Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also proudly operated by Battelle since 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Battelle that has supposedly come up with the memory metal. So was kind of an interesting little tidbit of some of the interesting hits on my website.
Yeah. Two things about that. Mm-hmm. One, there's a lot of people that are interested in the UFO subject, and they work at these places. Doesn't mean they're doing any work for them and looking at you, although it might.
You never know.
And the other is, don't you think if somebody really wants to watch you, they can cover, if they're in the government or at some company, they have people that are smart enough to cover their tracks?
True.
It may be impossible. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a computer person, but with computers, there's always a way to do something. Hack into anything, whatever, no matter who you are or what safeguards you put in. Eventually, there's a way to figure it out. And the other part of that about that metal, nitinol metal, is I looked at Nick's post on this at the UFO Iconoclast site. Really good post. And they keep calling it memory metal because it was supposedly that metal that when you crumpled it up, it would reform into its original shape. Nitinol doesn't do that. Nitinol only reforms into its original shape when you heat it.
I saw a demonstration of that. It was interesting.
Yeah.
The guy just had it all look like a piece of wire all crumbled up.
Yeah.
And the guy just poured some warm water from a cup on it, and it just immediately, you know, as soon as that warm hit it, you know, wherever it hit it went into the shape that it was meant to be, and it spelled out the word hot.
Yeah. I wrote a thing on Uri Geller recently, which a lot of people got really angry with me for, because here's a weird connection, Uri Geller, Nitinol, Roswell. I've got a book where there's a bunch of different scientific experiments supposedly were done on Geller. And yeah, magicians and Geller and people can fool anybody, even scientists. However, they took a piece of nitinol wire, and you can't bend it unless, I think you have to heat it to bend it, and you also have to heat it to get it to unbend to whatever it was. That's why it's called memory metal. But they brought out sealed glass tubes to Geller with nitinol wire in it. He hadn't seen them. Nobody he was with had seen them or touched them before he saw them. All of this is if you believe what the report is, and, you know, this was a guy at a university doing this. I don't know if that means it's more trustworthy or not. But what the result was that without touching the wires and with a metal that will not bend unless you heat it to, I don't know, I guess at least 200 degrees, maybe, because if you pour warm water, close to boiling water on it, the only way to get it to bend and to hold its shape is to heat it. And he was able to bend the wires inside these sealed glass tubes without touching them. So either somebody's lying or something very weird's going on there. And, of course, people say, well, he lies once in a while. You know, he's maybe not even once in a while. He performs magic tricks to fool people. Yeah, but that's, you know, something we were talking about off the air. If somebody does something that's either wrong or deceptive.
Dishonest?
Well, wrong, dishonest, or deceptive once, does that mean that they're wrong, dishonest, and deceptive all the time? Maybe. But then you look at that study I just talked about, and, you know, what is it? I think what Geller does, and we'll get back to the UFO subject, is that he doesn't have the whatever he does on command, and so most of the time he doesn't, so he engages in magic tricks just to keep his reputation up. And that's too bad. that's really too bad, but that's his personality. He wants to be famous and have everybody looking at him and all that.
Well, he's been in the public eye for so long.
Yeah, well, that was his dream, was to be famous because of his disability, and so I think that that's more important to him than demonstrating the ability as being famous, unfortunately. But he's just one example.
True. Another question that Grant Cameron wanted to answer was, do you know if Paul McGovern is in actuality Richard Doty?
I would suspect yes, but I never talked to him about it, and if I did, he would have said no.
Okay. I
talked to him for the book, and people were like, well, he lied to you. Why do you believe anything he says? Because some of the stuff he told me checked out with what other people had told me, and not just government UFO, you know, disinformation people. I'm talking about about UFO researchers and just, you know, members of the general public and law enforcement people. Some of that stuff checked out. So he doesn't lie all the time. He just says what he thinks he needs to say at the time to make you happy or him happy or whatever. And then other things like, you know, what's your only source is Bill Moore and Richard Doty. Well, unless they're sitting there before they talk to me every single time and agreeing to lie about certain things and not knowing what I'm going to ask them beforehand, they sure agreed to lie about a lot of stuff beforehand over months of interviews, down to little details, like what color was so-and-so's tie when you first met him. Or I wouldn't even do that. I'd say, how was he dressed? How was Falcon dressed when you first met him? I asked them both that question. They gave me the exact same answer months apart. You know, what was he like? What was his personality like? Well, he wouldn't talk too much. All he cared was about the subject at hand, and if you asked him anything about his personal life, he would change the subject quickly. They both told me the exact same thing. And those are just obvious examples. There's all kinds of other, you know. So I will take it for granted that they were telling the truth on a lot of things. They matched up. Very small details happened over 25 years ago. So I think that's reasonable with anybody to assume that what I'm being told is fairly accurate. Now, if Doty tells me a story about Paul Benowitz going out somewhere and taking a picture of a UFO that's really clear and the government coming in and stealing it from him and keeping it in its archive somewhere and it causing a big sensation in intelligence circles, I have no way to check that out. I didn't even put it in the book, but he told me that story.
I understand that. That's a good point. Getting back to the Paul Benowitz story too. You mentioned earlier that you think that there is something underground wise near Dulce, and what made you change your mind about there being something there?
Because I talked to people one person who hadn't led me astray in the past, and people probably know who I'm talking about, and I'm not going to say who it is, that I used in the book. And another guy I met, I fly powered paragliders, and without power, too. You know, we fly with that big parachute-looking thing over your head. I was at a meet with a bunch of different pilots. And somebody said, "Oh, so and so used to work for the government, and he lives in New Mexico. Maybe he knows something about what's going on with your books." So I went and talked to him. He said, "Oh yeah, there's a facility there. There was one." And I said, "What?" I said, "How do you know?" He said, "Because I used to work in the underground facilities and tunnels and all that, and I hadn't been there, but a lot of people told me that there was a facility there." What? You know, did somebody send him out just to mess with me? I don't think I'm worth that kind of attention, so I have to think that two different people telling me that they're one, an insider knowing that that's there, and two, somebody who spent a lot of time in the area and talked to people who had seen certain things there, I'm going to have to trust that they're telling me the truth and take it slightly seriously instead of saying it's all disinformation, which I used to say. This is part of this changing your mind thing that we were also talking about. Were we talking about it? You should be able to change your mind based on new information, and that's what I'm trying to do. And now, that doesn't mean that there's aliens underground bases there, and you know, firefights and seven levels and all this. I think that's total junk. However, I think that story was spread just so they could find out who wanted to find out about this. And not the obvious people like John Lear or Bill Cooper or anything like that, but the less obvious people who talk to John Lear and Bill Cooper and go to the websites and all that, and watch the videos. You know what I mean?
Follow-up question to that was just posted in the auditorium, asking if you ever heard if it was connected with to any other location.
Yeah, that's what this former government employee told me.
Whether this location was connected with some other locations, like maybe tunnels or something.
The tunnels run all over the Southwest and connected to different places, and that has been the rumor and the stories and some of the craziest stuff you see coming out about underground stuff, and apparently there's some truth to it.
Wow.
There might be. You know, I don't know. I didn't check this guy out. I don't know his background and all that. I could do that, I suppose.
Now, that's another thing I've been on the fence over, you know, all these supposed underground bases all over the country with high-speed trains underground. And
I don't know about that. I guess it would have to be if you want to get people between these places. But, you know, if you read a book, especially a good one like Richard Souter's Underground Bases and Tunnels, you realize that not only is this stuff possible, very possible, it's actually quite probable because it makes a lot of sense. Now, if you want to hook that to aliens and UFOs and all this, that's another totally different, you know, subject. I think it's hooked into that subject matter by the people who want to keep these things secrets to keep it on the lunatic fringe. But, yeah, I mean, it's not only is it possible that there's a vast network of underground facilities, it's actually, to my mind, from what I've seen, very probable. And
we know we have the technology to do it. I mean, look at the tunnel going from England to France under the English Channel.
Yeah, but that was done with conventional boring. What Souter and other people are talking about is things with nuclear reactors with them in them that basically melt the rock as they go through it. And there are patents that were applied for these things, and I think they're actually built, which would make tunnel boring a lot easier. A little bit more dangerous, but a lot easier. And they wouldn't have to shore the tunnels up or put anything on them, because basically it melts the rock and you've got this smooth, glassy rock all the way through, you know, and when you tunnel through it.
Gosh, you know, I, to me, that kind of a process with technology, you know, that advanced of a technology just kind of seems a little far-fetched to me, but
patents,
I suppose there is a possibility.
But patents were applied for and granted, there are also other conventional boring machines which are a lot faster than, the ones that you normally would think of with a bunch of teeth on the front and all that. So, you know, maybe this is my conspiracy bent coming out. And the other thing is there are underground facilities. We've seen them. There was one on UFO Hunters when they did the Delcy show, which I thought was not a very good show. But just to prove to you, which is a very good thing they did on that show, that there are underground facilities. They are secret, or used to be secret, some of them. And some of them are quite large. And if the possibility exists and it's a good way to hide things, don't you think somebody that wanted to hide things would take advantage of it? Of course they would.
I agree on that. Oh, and speaking of UFO hunters, I meant to mention this at the beginning of the program. The program UFO Hunters is kind of in limbo right now on whether or not they'll go into a fourth season. However, there is an online petition that people can sign to try and keep the show going.
Right.
And it's on a website called Petitions Online. So, you know, if you guys want to find that and sign it, go for it. I approve. I've signed it myself. I think it's a very good program, and I think they do a fairly decent job.
Yep. I don't agree with you. I don't think they do that much of a decent job. But then I've got strongly held opinions that don't agree with a lot of other people. And I wasn't going to vote for it, and then I was thinking, my reasoning went, but if the show is popular and more people watch it and it stays on, more people are exposed to the subject matter and encouraged to look into it themselves. And one of those people, or a few of them, might break the whole thing open and send UFO research into a totally different direction that's more fruitful than what it is now. And for that reason, that show should stay on.
I think they do pretty good at ufology 101, I guess you could call it.
I guess so, but when I'm watching it, I think, like when I was watching The X-Files, which I stopped watching, I didn't really like that show, because I'd watch it and go, why didn't they talk about, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different things?
True.
This would make, there's so much more to this story that would convince a lot more people, but they don't do it, and, I'm not privy to the editing and the producers' wishes and whatever. I really don't. And I don't think Bill Burns, or any of the people on there really have much say in how the stuff is presented. They don't. I mean, editing can do some crazy things to what you originally thought was going on.
So I
don't blame Bill Burns for the stuff that I'm unhappy with the show about. I don't agree with him on a lot of things either. But
I
should be killed.
I agree with you on that point about Bill Burns. However, I think that they're doing a good job at getting ufology out to the masses.
Yeah, and the other thing is, if the show does well, then other stations will, other networks will say, "Hey, this show's doing real well," and they'll start more of them.
Which would hurt my
feelings. There might be a better one. Who knows?
Well, and then when they do go investigate sightings, like, they did Stephenville, which I mentioned earlier, and I thought they did a pretty good job going in and interviewing some of the people that witnessed this event.
Mm-hmm. No, occasionally they'll do things like, great, 100%, they're right on with that. But, I said, just because I don't think they do a great job all the time doesn't mean they should be taken off the air. If that show gets pulled up, it pulls everybody up. Even if you think that it's ufology 101 and it's dumbing people down or whatever you want to say. No, it's getting exposure for the subject in a way that's to a lot of people seems to be serious. And I think they're serious about it too. I'm just serious in a different way.
Okay, just changing gears here. I'm intrigued by your involvement in Weird California. I bought a copy of Weird Arizona for my grandson, mm-hmm. and before I sent it to him, my husband and I were both reading through it and loved it. It was a great book.
Mm-hmm.
When was Weird California released, or has it been released yet?
Oh yeah, it was released in 2006, I think.
Okay. What part did you play in the writing of this book?
I wrote probably about 70% of it.
Oh, interesting.
They did not attribute the articles, unless there was something personal in it where I said I and they decided to leave it in, and I really can't stand putting I in feature writing because usually people abuse that privilege. I don't care what happened to you. All I want to know is what's going on. But a couple of them I actually said, I thought, well, this is important. I actually went through this, so let me put this on. And they actually put my name at the end of the article, like the one on Topanga Canyon, because I used to live there. But they contacted me because the guy they originally had to do it, who had written a book, Paul Young wrote a book called L.A. Exposed. And Paul Young was working for Variety, I think, at the time as an editor. And he said, well, I don't have time to do this, but there's another guy I know, Greg Bishop, and why don't you contact him? So he did, and I sent them a whole bunch of proposed stories. They modified it, asked me to do some stuff that they added, and I ended up writing something like 80 articles for that, 80 entries for it, and I think they probably used about 60 of them. And then they put out another book called Weird Hauntings, and two of the stories I'd written that weren't in Weird California appeared in that one.
Oh, wow. I'm intrigued when you said Topanga Canyon, because as you know, I'm originally from Southern California, and I'm familiar with the area. Is your article on Topanga Canyon covering the UFO sightings, or is it something different?
Yeah, UFO sightings, and then Preston Dennett, I think, wrote a book about Topanga Canyon because he lives there. He's like
I've had him on.
He's a book writing machine. I asked him about Topanga Canyon, and he provided me some quotes for the article, and also I looked at his book on it, and yeah, there's the UFO stuff in there, and I think Stephen Greer and his group came out there once with a TV show. But there's a lot of weird stuff going on there, and there has been. I lived there for 4 years, and the big wave of sightings happened the month after I moved away.
Oh, isn't that the way it is? All the good stuff happens either before you get there or after you leave?
Always, yeah. It seems I've complained about it on UFO Mystic. There was along with the UFO sightings, there was a story from some woman said she was driving up the road at about 2 a.m. She saw this thing that she said looked possibly like a goat, but not really. And it didn't really walk like an animal. It kind of bounced like it had springs on, she said. And then it turned and looked at her, and she said that when she looked at its eyes, she could see through its eyes to the background. So
oh, wow.
It's a good, creepy, wonderful story. Who knows where it came from or if it's true or whatever. But I thought it was a good story to include in the article, which I did. And that's from Preston Dennett's book.
Yeah, in fact, in the mass of books here on my desk, I have UFOs over Topanga Canyon. And have talked extensively with Preston about the sightings there. It's an interesting area. Are they still having sightings there, or
it's tailed off? But it's always been a place where people see weird stuff. It's weird because it's right next to this huge urban area, Los Angeles. But when you get there, it's totally silent, and you can see the stars. And you know, it takes about half an hour to get into LA from, or maybe 10 minutes to get into San Fernando Valley from Topanga. But it's basically like a rural area right next to LA. Danny Elfman has a house up there.
Really?
Yeah, I remember people would tell me their kids they couldn't wait to go to Danny Elfman's house at Halloween because he always had the best stuff and the greatest display out front. So.
By chance, are you familiar with the area in California that has been nicknamed Triangle Alley? And have you heard or investigated any of the triangle sightings or sighting reports from that area?
I didn't know anything that was called that, but I know that people have been seeing these flying floating triangles out in the desert areas of California, specifically out in the Mojave and then into Lancaster and Palmdale, which are north of Los Angeles. And, of course, Lancaster and Palmdale are home to Edwards Air Force Base, to McDonnell Douglas's Plant 42, I think maybe Lockheed Martin. Well, it's not McDonnell Douglas anymore. They got bought up. But a lot of defense contractors out there. And if people say that they see these large, slow-moving objects that are triangle or boomerang-shaped, I tend to think that they're lighter than aircraft that are being tested. Because if you look on it, all over the Internet, there are companies developing these things as spy platforms so that they can go up in the atmosphere like 100,000 feet and just sit there for days and days and days taking pictures and video of things. I think that's what those things are. Now, when you go into them moving very quickly, like a lighter-than-air ship won't, I don't have an explanation for that. They're truly unidentified. But the slow-moving ones, I'm pretty certain at this point, low-flying, lighter-than-aircraft that they're flying at night. Because you can see pictures of them, that's exactly what they're shaped like.
Yeah, I have seen pictures. The thing is, they've been showing up. These triangular craft have been showing up since, you know, 1980 and all the way, you know, into Europe.
Yeah, and the ones specifically in where was it, Holland or Belgium?
Belgium, yes.
Yeah, those are a little bit more problematic because I think some of the reports on those, there's things going on with them that don't really have anything to do with lighter than aircraft. But what I was trying to say when I interrupted you was that people have to remember that military technology is 10, 20 years ahead of what we think it is. And what that includes at this point, I do not know. But when somebody who hasn't seen anything like that before sees it, essentially it's going to be unidentified to them.
That's a valid point.
A lot of, you know, a lot of sightings, especially near military bases, I happen to think are just, you know, and this is, you know, I don't, this is not a original opinion in any way, but I happen to think a lot of those are just, you know, tests of things that people happen to see. You know, I don't think that all UFO sightings are military craft, though. I mean, it seems almost impossible to me with, the one, the number of sightings, and two, some of the things that what happens in the sightings, like dematerialization. Well, actually, that could happen, too, because they're talking about cloaking devices now that have skin on them that can project whatever's behind it. So no matter where you are, you're just seeing the background, so you see kind of a outline if you know where to look. So, you know, that might be another instance of military technology being mistaken for and unidentified. I don't know. But just because of the history of the UFO subject, the amount of sightings, the quality of them, and the difference between them, and the really strange aspects of some of them, there's no way that anybody that looks at this for a while can say that every UFO is a military project. I think that's erroneous.
Well, we have about 4 minutes left. If you have any speaking engagements coming up or new projects that you want to tell about, or I'll offer your website.
Yeah, I write weekly and usually daily at UFOmystic.com along with Nick Redfern. People can go to my website that kind of has my magazine frozen in carbonite, which is excludedmiddle.com. The books are Wake Up Down There, which is a collection of stuff from the Excluded Middle magazine, and some stuff that wasn't in the magazine called A Virtual Issue, which we put in there, Project Beta, which we've been talking about, and Weird California are the three books that I'm usually associated with. Projects right now, I'm writing an article on Dulce right now and the history of it and what might be there. Let's see what else. I'm trying to get people to bite on book ideas, which hasn't been going real well, but, you know, you just plug away at it. And then I have other sites, too. One of them is a weird music site called Music Not Music, where I just put up strange music, which has nothing to do with UFOs, usually. I've got, you know, recordings of an exorcism and Argentinian wrestling show music and weird stuff like
that. You know, Grant asked about that last night as well, too.
Oh, did he? Yeah, well, he can just go there and take a look at it. I don't think I have any UFO stuff up there right now. At UFO Mystic, there's a whole section on music, and I've put up, until I find more, like 30 or 40 different UFO and flying saucer-related songs from the 1940s up to the present. Mostly concentrating, I think, most on the 50s and 60s, with a few from later. But that's another part of the things I'm interested in, is just music associated and the pop culture associated with the UFO subject.
Oh, well, then you need, I think the name of the band is Warp 7, and they're original series Star Trek bunch, and all their songs are Star Trek related. It's really funny.
I've heard of them, but I haven't heard any of the... I don't think I've heard any of their songs. I was just listening to
them. Oh, gosh, I think we have some stuff on YouTube.
Oh, okay, I'll check it out. And I'll be speaking at the, what's the name of the conference? Damn it, I can't remember. I remember the organizer, Janet Saylor, but it's in Angel Fire, New Mexico in September. All you have to look up is UFO Conference, Angel Fire September. And then in November... And Nick's going to be there as well, as well as a few other people. And then November, there's the UFO Info Conference in Florida, near Orlando, and I'll be at that.
Cocoa Beach.
Huh?
Cocoa Beach.
Oh, is it? Okay. And that'll be a fun one, too, because it's apparently it's time to coincide with one of the final shuttle launches. And I've never seen a shuttle go up, so I'm hoping I'll get to see that. But yeah,
that's one I'd love to go to myself.
Yeah. I don't know what I'm speaking at yet about yet at Angel Fire, but I want to try to get the people from the UFO Info Conference to let me do my why I'm interested in UFOs and why the subject is so fun speech, where I do actually play some of these UFO flying saucer songs, discuss some very strange cases, some of my favorites, and really don't make any conclusions about it, because if you make a conclusion about the UFO subject or anything associated with it, then you're probably at least partially wrong.
Okay. And on that note, unfortunately, we're all out of time. That 2 hours just went just too fast.
Yeah, it went real fast. It seems like we were just on the phone about 5 minutes.
Doesn't it, though?
Yeah.
Hey, and I thank you very much for joining us tonight. I had a blast.
Thank you. I did, too, Dee. It's funny. Every show has a different kind of aspect to it, and I you know, a lot of times I don't get to say things that I don't normally say, and I got to do that this time, so I thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I like it when we get to speak our minds. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I wish to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all of those who joined us in our Pal Talk auditorium. You're, as always, a wonderful group. Stay tuned for Voices of People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight is author Michael Aaron Casteras, I believe that's how it's pronounced. Please join us again next Saturday on UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be my dear friend, Peter Robbins. Until then, keep an eye to the sky, and good night, everyone.